I came up against a situation which I thought wasn't right. I was invited to join the new church in Australia, and I was given a membership form to sign, but there was no mention of baptism on it. And that made me think that there was something really odd about this, because there's a whole chapter on baptism in true Christian religion, as we all know. So, to really get down to business, I must start with the Reverend Bruce Williams' paper on baptism, which I've got an excerpt from it. Now, I was given a copy of this paper, and Bruce Williams was, when he wrote this paper, sorry, I'm in the way, when Bruce Williams wrote this paper, well, he did it in a number of sections, and these sections were published, I believe, in the New Age. And anyway, the whole document was given to me, and I read this particular part. But the new church doctrine did not suggest a demand for rebaptism. Now, when I read that, it didn't ring true at all. Bruce Williams went on to note in his paper that the first rebaptisms occurred in the very first worship service of the new church in England and the world on the 31st of July, 1787. It's not that clear. Now, this bit. Now, Bruce Williams, in commenting on these five rebaptisms, he said that he put this down to understandable zeal and excitement which prevailed in those early days at the discovery of the new doctrines. Now, the implication is that the rebaptisms weren't really necessary, in line with the point of view he develops in the rest of his paper. Now, that's a very important remark to make. And I think, when I read those words, it just didn't ring true at all. Because we know that the revelation of the heavenly doctrines occurred, which is the second advent of the Lord, occurred around about 17 centuries after the first advent. And Swedenborg finished writing his theological books in 1770, and 17 years later, in 1787, we had the first appearance of the new church in external form in the world. And this was on the 31st of July, 1787. Now, the number 17 is not coincidental. 17, if you look at the Arcana, Coelestia, in numbers, but anyway, it's there, and we'll come across that later. It means a new beginning. It signifies a new beginning. Now I'm going to have a closer look at the start of the new church. So let's go to the next slide. Now, this was done with a lot of preparation. A lot of preparation went into things before the first worship service. And we're told in Robert Hindmarsh's Rise and Progress, this is a book that he wrote about the early days of the new church. In this book, he says that a group of people around John Glenn put together a set of principles which the new church was to follow. And this was done prior to the first worship service. So there was very careful preparation. What they were also very keen to do was to get everything put together which was in total harmony with the heavenly doctrines as far as they could. they were very conscious of the fact that they were making a complete break with the old church, and they were embarking on something entirely new, with its own revelation. Now, one of the principles, as I've got here, is that right from the start, am I in the way, by the way, and you can't see?
Not any more than necessary.
Oh, okay. Right from the start of the external form of the organized new church, introduction into the new church was to be solely through the spiritual correspondent baptism performed in that church. That's from Hindmarsh's Rise and Progress. So, right at the very beginning of the new church, we have this focus on baptism, and that's the way, that's the gate of entrance into the new church. And of course, in the first worship service, five people were rebaptized. Now, they had been baptized previously in the Christian church, but they were rebaptized at the first worship service. Now, there's another very important aspect of this whole thing, and that is that we're told in true Christian religion that the new church was inaugurated by the Lord. Now, a number of things flow from this. We're told in true Christian religion, 667, that the new church was inaugurated by the Lord. Now, a number of things flow from this, and I've got them listed up there. The first one, the number 17, the new beginning, the reference in Arcana AC 853. The five rebaptisms were necessary and orderly. Now, how does that conclusion follow? That conclusion follows because if it was inaugurated by the Lord, the divine providence which governs everything that happens would have ensured that these five rebaptisms were necessary and orderly. Yes?
Happens like angle questions.
Yeah,
at
that's
end,
fine.
At the end or during?
Well, on the way through, if you wish.
Well, what's now? What suits your style better? Maybe all at the end, maybe.
Okay, at the end. Right then. Actually, while we're having a break, I'll just get some
water. Thanks for that.
My mouth gets very dry. Okay. So, we can conclude that these five rebaptisms were necessary. Now, was the early new church fruitful? Thanks, David. Well, the early new church in Britain was very fruitful. It grew and it spread. It reached a high water mark when there was something like about, I don't know, 60 or 70, perhaps you can help me here, Julian.
Numerically, it reached its peak, numerically,
yeah.
In 1910.
1910,
okay.
Right.
Which then it
started to decline.
It started to numerically tail off.
Right, okay.
Very gradually.
So, from that, we have to conclude that the early new church was fruitful. and there's a very important spiritual principle involved in that. And that is that everything that has life in it from the Lord is fruitful and multiplies without limit. And that's Akana question number 43. Now, did this happen? Well, we saw it happen. Was the establishment of the external form of the new church fruitful? I think the answer is yes. The first new church society in Britain grew substantially, and the new church teaching spread far and wide and to America through one of the early receivers called John Glenn, who was right there present at the first worship service, and he was one of the people that drew up the paper principles that fulfilled, adopted, unanimously adopted. There was a conference of the new church. The first conference of the new church occurred on the 13th of April, 1789. So that's only 2 years later. So it did spread very quickly. Now, there's another. What I've got here is the law of the first in the series is an important spiritual principle. It's an important teaching of the new church that in any divine work, the essence and quality of the beginning is derived and passes over into the things which follow. In other words, the beginning reigns in the things which follow. We are further told that the first is the all in the products and derivatives, such that if the first be removed, the things which follow perish. Now, the conclusion from this, by the law of the first in the series, it must therefore be the pattern that the new church should follow with regard to rebaptism. Happening in the first church, first worship service, that's where the pattern is set. That's in line with the spiritual principle of the first in the series, follows through all the rest that follows. Any deviation, such as making new church rebaptism optional and only available on request, can be seen as disorderly by breaking the law of the first in the series. Following the pattern of the first worship service then constitutes a reason for rebaptism into the new church. Now let's have a look at the distinctiveness of the new church. The distinctiveness of the new church lies in its newness. And you can approach this question of newness from two angles. The old church, A, the old church has written itself off, and B, the new church is really new. Now, the new church, let's take these in turn. The new church has written itself off.
Christian church has written itself off.
Yes, sorry. The Christian church has written itself off. We are cautioned in TCR 171 that in any church, not only all its worship, but also all its dogma, ultimately go back to that church's faith. Mm-hmm. You could say then that the nature of a church's faith determines the nature of its teachings. It follows that the faith in question, because it is a faith in three gods, has perverted every aspect of the church. Faith is an origin, teaching is derived from it. What is derived receives its essence from its origin. I'll repeat that. What is derived received its essence from its origin. TCR 171 continues. If you carefully examine the church's individual teachings, for example, on God, the person of Christ, goodwill, repentance, regeneration, free choice, the selection of the chosen people, and I've underlined this bit, the purpose of the sacraments of baptism and the Holy Supper, you will clearly see that there is a trinity of gods in each one of them. If some teaching does not make the trinity completely apparent, it still flows from the trinity the way water flows from a spring. If the source is polluted, the downstream water is polluted, in short. So the only conclusion we can draw here is that we need to rebaptize because baptism in the Christian church is polluted by the Trinity of God's falsity. This constitutes a second reason for new church rebaptism. Now, the second aspect of newness is the new church is really new. Now, the early receivers, this is a quote from Hindmarsh's Rise and Progress, page 69. The early receivers themselves say that the new church is distinct from the old, as shown by the declaration of Revelation 21:5. Behold, I make all things new with regard to the new church. This declaration applies not only to the doctrines of the church, but also to its institutions and ordinances of every kind, and to that of the ordination of ministers, whose authority to teach and preach and administer the sacraments must be derived from the Lord alone in his own church, and not from any priesthood of a fallen, consummated, and finished church. So, what's the answer? What's new about new church baptism? Well, the answer is that in the new church we have a clear understanding of and faith in the true God, who is the Lord God Jesus Christ in his glorified human body. As we've seen, the new church teaching on baptism has its essence derived from its origin, which is faith in the one true God. His second coming revelation also tells us that the spiritual sense of the word has been revealed for the sake of the new church, inaugurated by the Lord on 31 July 1787. A clear understanding of the Lord and revelation of the spiritual sense of the word enables people to know what is involved in and affected by new church baptism, and therefore makes it new. This spiritual enlightenment is lacking in Christian church baptism, and so the call for newness points to new church rebaptism. Now, moving on, baptism, if we turn to chapter 12 of True Christian Religion, we find there that in number 668, that baptism was commanded by the Lord. And this is the fourth reason for rebaptism into the new church. And baptism was commanded by the Lord. Since the new church is Christian in fact and essence, whereas the previous church was merely Christian in name only, this is what Swedenborg says, by the way, in TCR 668. Or to put it another way, real Christianity is now, 1770, for the first time arising, TCR 700. And so the Lord's command to baptize has new meaning and force. We must baptize as commanded by the Lord. After all, true Christian religion is addressed to us, to the new church. People from outside the new church, of course, are welcome to read it, but essentially it's a book for us, and we are told in it to baptize, and I believe that that is what we should be doing. Now, so the question is, how are we, the new church, complying with the Lord's commandment to baptize or rebaptize, if we are tacitly accepting that the Christian church is doing the baptizing for us? Now, summing up, there are four reasons that I've given for why we should rebaptize people coming from the Christian church. And they're listed there. Reasons why we should rebaptize into the new church: those baptized Christians wanting to join us. The five rebaptism Rebaptisms in the first new church worship service in 1787 were orderly. So by the law, the first in the series, where the first is the all in all that follows, it must therefore be the pattern that the new church should follow. So we need to baptize or rebaptize into the new church, as the case may be. Second reason, all worship and dogma in the Christian church, including the sacrament of baptism, is tainted by its core faith in the Trinity of God's falsity. This alone makes its baptism unsuitable as the gate of entrance into the new church. Third reason. In Revelation 21:5, the Lord says, with regard to the new church, "Behold, I make all things new." The new church provides a clear understanding of the Lord, and its revelation of his spiritual sense of the word enables people to know what is involved in and effected by new church baptism. This is what makes it new. If all things are to be made new, Christian church baptism fails this test. Fourth reason for rebaptism that I've come across into the new church is that the Lord has commanded the Christian church to baptize. Since the new church is Christian in fact and essence, whereas the previous church was merely Christian in name only, therefore we, the new church, are directly commanded to baptize by the Lord in TCR 668. Now, I've put the question here, if rebaptism into the new church is orderly, is ignoring rebaptism unless it is requested orderly? Now, this is my opinion. The rationale for regarding rebaptism as unnecessary for someone from the Christian church desiring to join the new church depends on the previous baptism having occurred. Here we are tacitly accepting that the Christian church has done the baptizing for us. For the reasons given earlier, Christian church baptism is inappropriate for entry into the new church, and so failing to indicate an expectation of either baptism or rebaptism can be seen as disorderly. Rebaptism ensures that the new church in Australia does not rely on an inappropriate earlier baptism in a different church. If this conclusion is correct, the disorder is on the part of the organised new church and not on the individual. In any of this, the individual coming from the Christian church, his salvation situation, I don't believe is affected on the individual's part. And as far as the organised church is concerned, what I'm saying here is that there's a minor adjustment required. That's how I would put it. This is not a big earth-shaking thing. It's something that if the case that I've put, if these four reasons stand up, then to get more in line with guidance from the Word and the heavenly doctrines, this is what the new church in Australia should be doing. The Now, why bother with all of this? Is this nitpicking? There might be people who think it is, but I think it isn't, because it clashes with passages from the heavenly doctrines which you read, and when you read them, you realise that this is not what's happening on the ground, if you like. And that always creates unease. Put it no higher than that. And the Lord sees the whole human race as one person, and the heart in that person is the specific church. Anything that we can do to help the health of that heart, which is the new church, is building up the church. So I would see this as, if the case that I've given has any merit, now I say it's got merit, but that's my personal point of view. If other people think it's got merit and they go ahead and do something and make some changes, make some adjustments, and what changes are we looking for? It's managing of expectations. Like people coming from the Christian church and wanting to join us, all I'm suggesting is that they be made aware, if they ask questions of people like ministers, or they have access to introductory pamphlets, that the expectation is that they are baptized. Not that they have a choice whereby they can waive new church baptism and become members. That's the heart of it all. And it seems to me that just a small adjustment is required. I also came across a teaching which bears on all of this, but in a very general sense, and I'll show you that. And it's to do with truth and falsity. I thought this was a very interesting passage. It's from TCR 759. Falsity cannot see truth, but truth can see falsity. And everyone is so made that he can see and grasp truth in hearing it. But if he has convinced himself of false doctrines, he cannot bring truth into his understanding so as to lodge there, since it finds no room. And if by chance it does get in, the crowd of falsities gathered together there throw it out as not belonging. Now, I'm not addressing that at anybody in particular. I'm just saying that that applies to me as much as anybody else. But it's just something that suggests that if we're holding bad ideas or false ideas, some falsities are in our minds, we can fall into this, where this passage applies. So anyway, anybody got any questions?
Question. Yes.